Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea on the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminder to sign up for our weekly email that you can get through Substack, readinghistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I have discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our dearest friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Korach has always been a misunderstood character, in my opinion. His very name sounds evil, like the villain in a Disney movie, whose very name signals to the audience they're going to be the bad guy. The name Korach literally means bald or chilly. It is clear he's going to be the villain in the story. Yet from the actual story, it is not quite clear why he was even considered such a villain. The ambiguities begin with the very introduction of Korach. Vayikach Korach, and Korach took, the Parsha begins, but never really explains what he took. Nearly all of the commentators weigh in on this. Rashi explains, based on Unkelus's translation, that the language took refers to his adversarialness. Korach removed himself from the mainstream by arguing with Moshe. But why begin by introducing Korach in such a vague manner altogether? Whatever the term vayikach and he took refers to, would it not have been easier to just write it out more clearly? Korach's actual rebellion is also quite unclear. The Torah describes it as follows: Vayikalu al Moshe v'al Aaron v'yomru alehem Rav lachem ki chol ha'eda kulam kedoshim u'besocham Hashem u'madua tisnasu al kahal Hashem. They all gathered together against Moshe and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far, for all of the community is holy, all of them, and God is in their midst. Why then do you raise yourself above God's congregation?" Doesn't Korach have a point here? The Jewish community is entirely holy. Is it so awful that he pointed this out? Rashi cites the Medrash that adds more detail to the complaint of Korach. Elu krue ha'eda, Rashi writes, v'hil bishan taliso shakulan tchelas ba'u va'amdu lefnei Moshe amru lo talis shakulo shal tchelas chayeves betzitzis o petura. Amar la Hem chayeves hitchilu l'schok alav efshar talis shel min acher chut echad shel tchelas potra zu shakulu tchelas lo tiftores atzma. Korach came before Moshe dressed in garments entirely made of blue dye known as tchelas, and asked Moshe if such a garment still required tzitzis. Normally tzitzis have one string made of blue. Here Korach asked if the entire garment was made from tchelas dye, would a blue string still be necessary? Where on earth did the Medrash find that a central part of Korach's complaint against Moshe had to do with tzitzis? Of course, the last parsha ended with the commandment to wear tzitzis, but why did the Medrash make this imagery so central in the story of Korach? To understand all of this, let's explore the fascinating history of the Jewish confrontation with socialism. Karl Marx was no friend to religion. Born in 1818 to parents who both descended from rabbinic families, he was baptized as a young child. After a fairly unremarkable career as a journalist, Marx was drawn to the philosophy of German philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, particularly his approach to history, known as Hegelian dialect, which understands historical progress as the resolution of contradicting ideals that yields a third best option. Simply put, according to this Hegelian dialect, history is a repeated three-step process with a thesis, that's whatever's happening now, the current state of affairs, the antithesis, the antithesis, that's the word we use, that's the reaction, the issue or the challenges to the current state, and synthesis, the resolution of the conflict, which creates a better approach through combining both ideals, the thesis and the antithesis. Most famously, Marx criticized religion as an impediment for Hegelian progress. Marx believed that religion perpetuates the status quo by offering an illusionary sense of happiness and hope, which distracts people from the need to challenge and change the oppressive conditions they live under. Instead of addressing the root causes of their suffering, such as capitalist exploitation and class inequality, religion encourages passive acceptance and resignation Christian. As Marx famously wrote, religious suffering is, at one and the same time, the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless condition. It is the opium of the masses. As an aside, I still think about this comment from somebody on social media named Bridget Fetisi. I don't know who it is. Herself, she's a recovered heroin addict, who one time wrote, if Karl Marx was right and religion is the opium for the masses, I find it telling that with the rise of secularism, the masses are increasingly turning to opioids. It's a haunting statement. Let's get back to it, though. Marx, however, proposed that religion was halting societal progress. Instead of religion serving to comfort man's sorrows, Marx proposed historical materialism, whereby history should be judged based on the material conditions, the physical life it provides society rather than its ideals. Economic factors, especially the modes of production, how goods and services are produced, shape society's structure and development rather than religious practice or ideals. According to Marx, all of history is marked by the conflict between different social classes. In a capitalist society, this struggle is primarily between the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class who owns the means of production, and the proletariat, the working class who sell their labor. This struggle led to capitalist exploitation, the difference between what workers are paid and the value of what they produce. He argued that capitalists exploit workers by paying them less than the value of their labor, thereby generating profit for themselves. Overall, Marx argued that capitalism alienates workers from their labor, the products they produce, their fellow workers, and their own humanity. Workers are treated as mere cogs in a machine, losing their sense of creativity and purpose. Honestly, I live in a capitalist society. Some of this really resonates. The ultimate goal of Marxist socialism is to achieve a classless, stateless society known as communism. In this society, the means of production would be collectively owned and goods and services would be distributed based on need rather than profit. Marx envisioned this as a society where people would be free from exploitation and alienation, allowing for the full development of human potential. If you hear some messianic undertones in Marx's vision, you would not be completely wrong. Marx is rarely treated kindly in the Jewish context because of his own alienation from Jewish life, as well as his antagonistic words towards religion and Judaism in particular. In 1844, there's a lot of 1840s actually going on, so brace yourselves. Karl Marx published his essay On the Jewish Question as a critique of Bruno Bauer, another German philosopher. Bauer had argued that Jews could only achieve political emancipation by renouncing their religious identity. Marx's essay responds to Bauer's argument and goes beyond the specific issue of Jewish emancipation to discuss broader themes of political and human emancipation. The essay has been interpreted by many as having latent anti-Semitic themes, including the image of the Jew as being inexorably connected to capitalist pursuits. Some scholars are more charitable, noting that Marx's essay really only uses the Jewish people as an analogy, but the essay certainly has been championed by anti-Semites and did not ingratiate Marx's legacy for the Jewish community. And it is Marx's unhealthy relationship with religion that makes it all the more surprising to so many the religious roots and connections within the socialist movement. Aaron Shmuel Lieberman is one such figure. Born in 1843 and died in relative obscurity, he's actually buried, I think, in Queens, by taking his own life after a married woman he was in love with refused to leave her husband for him. What a way to go. For those who remember him, however, he is known as the father of Jewish socialism. What makes his brand of socialist philosophy so unique is that he explicitly couches his argument for a socialist society in Kabbalistic terminology. As Eliyahu Stern demonstrates in his fascinating article, which of course we have links to in our weekly email, readingjewishhistorytheparsha.substack.com. In his article, Marx and the Kabbalah, Aaron Shmuel Lieberman's Materialist Interpretation of Jewish History, Lieberman's work is littered with references to the mysticism of Rav Isaac Luria, known as the Arizal, as well as the works of Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzer Matzato, known, of course, as the Ramchal. As Stern explains, Lieberman adopted Luria's basic temporal scheme that identified the imbalances and injustices of history as a function of creation. The religious imbalances and injustices of the world, as described by the Arizal, became analogies for economic and societal issues in the work of Lieberman. The translation from mystical imbalances to economic injustices was paved in the works of Lieberman by his interpretation of the Ramchal, specifically in his work Klach Pischei Chachma, which translates as 138 Gates of Wisdom. Klach is a gematria, Kuf Lamed Ches, 138. Klach Pischei Chachma is his work, 138 Gates of Wisdom. In the works of the Ramchal, Lieberman saw, as understood by Stern, that buried in Luzzatto's writing, one can see a rigorous messianic theory that emphasized the unique role of the Jewish people in bringing about a universal social and political revolution. This may not be such a radical rereading of the Ramchal as it would at first seem. Jonathan Garb already noted in his article, The Circle of Moshe Chaim Luzzatto in its 18th century context, that much of the work of the Ramchal was dedicated to, and I quote, the general translation of the Kabbalistic myth into this worldly terms, which are primarily political. I know for a lot of people, hearing this reading of the Ramchal is very surprising, especially if you only know the works of the Ramchal from his work Mesilas Yesharim. He happens to be one of the most fascinating and radical figures in all of Jewish history, and it's actually not all that surprising that this Aaron Shmuel Lieberman found within the works of the Ramchal a reason to embrace socialism. Lieberman, however, was not alone in trying to couch a socialist revolution in mystical terminology. Most notably, Rav Yehuda Ashlag, known as the Baal HaSulam, after his commentary on the Zohar, was quite outspoken about his socialist leanings. Aside from his command of Kabbalah, Rav Ashlag was familiar with many philosophical writings, including Spinoza, Hegel, Rawls, that's a famous moral philosophy, and Schopenhauer. As Chaim Rothman details in his fascinating work, this work is a wild book, it's called, I mean, you can hear it's wild from the title, No Masters But God, Portraits of Anarcho-Judaism. Buckle up, it's a wild book, which includes an entire section on Rav Ashlag's political philosophy. Rav Ashlag advocated for the adoption of altruistic communism in the state of Israel. Altruistic communism, Rav Ashlag argued, was the most Jewish approach to governance. Why else, Rav Ashlag explains, was the Torah given to the entirety of the Jewish people rather than just the individuals, our forefathers, if not to reinforce the notion of mutual responsibility? In fact, as the biography on Rav Ashlag recounts, Rav Ashlag met with Ben-Gurion on several occasions to advocate for the socialist basis of Zionism, as well as, and this is actually quite beautiful, observing the Shabbos in Israel as a national day of rest from work, a position that was eventually adopted by the State of Israel. As Adam Zagoria Moffitt summarizes in his master's thesis on Ashlag, entitled, great title, The Communist Kabbalist, The Political Theology of Rav Yehuda Ashlag, he finishes as follows, straddling the traditional world of the Beit Midrash and the modern ground of Marxist politics, Rav Ashlag carved for himself and for his descendants a new approach to mystical praxis, which took human action out of the exclusively cosmological realm of Luria's original formulation and plunged it into the psychological and political dimension simultaneously. The association of secularism and socialism has a particular rich history in the world of Chabad, given their Herculean efforts to preserve religious observance for Jews living under communist Russia rule. Still, as extensively documented by my dearest friend, and I owe a lot of this essay to him, a lot of this shir to him, and a lot of everything I give over to him, because he's absolutely wonderful, and you should read everything that he writes. His name is Rabbi Eli Rubin, an absolutely wonderful person, a scholar, Chabad Chassid, a huge Talmud Chacham. So as extensively documented by Rabbi Eli Rubin, there were voices within the Chabad movement that did not see socialism and religious devotion as necessarily mutually exclusive. One notable figure is Rav Avram Eliyahu Plotkin, whose short story, Kaddish Denied or The Living Orphan, considers how Hasidic fraternity and thought can address the socialist experience. In the short story, Moshe the Carpenter vehemently objects to the characterization of Jewish commitment as bourgeoisie trickery. Halacha is not something that the bourgeoisie is imposing on the Jewish people. Instead, as Eli Rubin explains in his wonderful article, The Soul of the Worker, Plotkin argues that religion can and should endure even in a socialist society. As Rubin writes, riffing on a Talmudic aphorism that proclaims all Jews, maminim b'nei maminim, believers, the son of believers, Moshe the carpenter in this story declares himself a worker, the son of a worker. His faith and his proletarianism are intrinsically fused, and he cannot abide the forced bifurcation of one aspect of his identity from another. The possibility of fusing socialism and religion was acknowledged by the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself. I was never of the opinion that there must be a conflict between a Jewish socialist worldview and a traditional religious ideology and lifestyle, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said. In Likutei Sichos, I have the original Yiddish. I am not going to try and read it because the Rebbe's Yiddish is so complicated and I would sound so ridiculous it would ruin this entire thing. So I'm not going to read it for you now. Still, the Rebbe saw specific merit in the capitalist system of the United States. A long-standing critique of capitalism was the need for people to rely on charity. Marx's closest friend and partner, Friedrich Engels, who actually eulogized Marx as the greatest thinker at Marx's funeral. How many people do you think were at Karl Marx's funeral? You probably guess wrong, there were only 11 people. Friedrich Engels described charity as follows. Charity which tread the downtrodden still deeper in the dust demand that the degraded, the pariah cast out of society, shall first surrender the last that remains to him, his very claim to manhood, shall first beg for mercy before your mercy deigns to press in the shape of alms, which means charity, the brand of degradation upon his brow. It's a very negative look at charity. It's basically saying that charity is sustaining inequality. The Rebbe, however, saw this as the very greatness of a capitalist society, and that it gives everyone the opportunity to contribute in their own unique way. In a 1956 letter to Dr. Elkanah, the Rebbe defends the opportunities that emerge in a society with different levels of socioeconomic well-being. And I'll read, I have obviously a link to the original letter, but I'm going to read the translation, which I got from Eli Rubin in his book, Social Vision. This is what the Rebbe wrote to Dr. Elkanah. You know, I'll read the Hebrew. Vasher l'si mechtavo bo kosei vasher ein ha-ge'ulo yichol with regard, this is the translation to the conclusion of your letter, in which you write that the redemption cannot be complete until the needy disappear from the earth and all people work collectively with mutual responsibility and without poor and wealthy, basically socialism, the Rebbe says, I do not concur with your opinion because the nature of a person is that a feeling of true happiness comes to a person when he is able to do something for the good of another. And this is only possible when one is rich and the second is poor. And of course, in a capitalist society, we're not just talking about rich and poor in terms of wealth and dollars. Everybody has something that they're not good at, and somebody else has something that they are good at, which is exactly the foundation of what makes capitalism run. According to John Smith and all the early capitalists, everyone is working together for the greatest good with their unique talents. And as Eli Rubin explains in his book Social Vision, which is an absolute must read, to utterly eradicate any and all imbalances would be to eradicate the possibility of true happiness. And this brings us back to our Parsha. I once heard that the Kloisenberger Rebbe would refer to Korach as Der Heile Gezede, his holy grandfather. His ideas conceptually were holy. He wanted a community of equals. But as Rav Tzadok explained, sometimes ideas are wrong, not because they are unjust, but because their time has not yet come. And this was the mistake of Korach. He wanted to usher in the end of times when God's presence will be explicit explicitly revealed, and all hierarchies will collapse. V'zehu ta'os Korach, Reb Tzadok writes, shekeven shebe emes, b'shas matan Torah, hayo ro'oi lihios hatikun ha'amiti k'mo sheyeh la'asid. He thought that this was the end of times, like at matan Torah, God's revelation is here. The problem, however, is that such a time had not yet arrived. So long as human interpretation mediates our lives, hierarchy and leadership are necessary. And this is perhaps why our parsha begins with such a vague description of what Korach took. Each commentary interprets it differently. In a way, this highlights the very mistake of Korach. In a world of ambiguity, you need different interpretations, some better than others. So long as existence is interpreted through human reason rather than divine word, hierarchies and injustice will continue. It is humanity's responsibility to address and fix them in this very ambiguous world. And this is why Korach asked specifically about a garment that was made entirely of techeles. A talis envelops a person completely, like a home, like revelation itself. Korach wanted the present moment to reflect the reality of a garment made completely from wool, a world suffused with the divine, without hierarchy, without injustice. We are not yet in such a world, but through our redemptive acts of Jewish commitment, Torah and mitzvos, collectively, we each inch closer each and every day. So thank you so much for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all of the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly email that you can get at readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our friends and sponsors, Jana and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.